Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Not to get too personal, but are you eating lunch right now while listening to all of it? Maybe you're contemplating what you are going to eat for lunch or make for dinner. Well, hold on a minute, because our next guest might say something that will change your mind about what you plan to put in your pie hole. Guess what? The answer is not a lot of pie. Mark Bittman is one of the country's leading food journalists who wrote about food for the New York Times for 30 years. He is the author of dozens of books, including his latest, How to Eat. His co-author, Dr. David Katz, is the founding director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center, and both join me in studio. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Listeners, the full name of Mark and David's book is How to Eat All Your Food and Diet Questions Answered. If you have a question for them, now's your chance. Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So, Mark, you titled the book How to Eat, not What to Eat, but How to Eat.
There's a debate about that.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. I was going to say, so I want to know what the difference is.
We thought how to eat, you know, you can get as specific as you want about what to eat. And as you said, people are thinking about lunch. Can we tell you what to eat for lunch? Well, not really. But we can give general guidelines, and they're pretty simple. But it still was a challenging decision because people just ask questions all the time. And you just don't know what the question's going to be. So we thought, it's a funny kind of book because the simple premise is pretty straightforward, but there are infinite numbers of questions, and we just tried to pick, you know, the most common 200 or so and answer them.
We did a good job of organizing the book, dividing it into categories from specifics to lifestyles to food choices to nutrition. So, Doctor, when we think about the word diet, because that's the word that pops into people's minds right away, what do we mean by diet? Should we not use it in certain contexts?
Interesting question. You know, back to the title. Of course, you know, Mark famously wrote How to Cook Everything. So how to eat, but not everything. You know, that kind of came out as an early contender. It sort of made sense. Well, you know, from our point of view, the first answer would be diet should really be a noun, not a verb, right? Because in this country, diet is a pastime. I'm on one today, I'm off one. Which one are you on? Did you try this one, right? I mean, it's kind of the national sport. And that's inevitably of the I need to lose weight fast so I can gain it back even faster with interest variety. And, you know, we oppose that. It's silly. It's no way to live. It's bad for you. It's bad for your self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, dysfunctional. So if diet is a noun, then what it really refers to is a dietary pattern. And ideally, that's about some assembly of foods that you actually enjoy, so they satisfy your palate, that work for your schedule and your routine. And if you have a family, work for your family. And maybe there's a cultural influence there. Mm-hmm. And it's sustainable, meaning for you over time, but also for the world at large. And it gives you pleasure. And it contributes to vitality and longevity and all the good stuff we all want, years in life, life in years. And so we approach the project thinking about diets, and one whole section of the book, of course, is about the competing diets. That's what we're talking about. Not, you know, we didn't even waste time really on, you know, what's the diet that will best help you lose 37 pounds in 22 minutes. We just ignored all that nonsense. So let's talk about dietary patterns that have some reasonable hope of helping people feel well, live well, enjoy pleasure from eating and pleasure from good health, and that could actually last a lifetime.
When we're talking about eating patterns, the one that I hear people talking about a lot is intermittent fasting.
You were just talking about it too.
See, there we go. Yeah.
Which is also really called skipping a meal.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually a not eating pattern. And you know, we were just joking out waiting for the interview about, you know, there's a book just out. I mean, inevitably, it's the latest dietary fad, so there's a new book on it. So, you know, what does it say? Page after page? Nope, not yet. Wait. Nope. I mean, who needs a book to not eat? Anyway, yeah.
Is there any science to back up that this is good for us?
So, Mark, chime in. But first of all, we have to be clear that intermittent fasting still means eating, and what you eat when you eat matters whenever you do that. So if you eat 5 days out of seven, or you go 16 hours every day without eating, when you eat, what you eat is your diet. And back to that former answer, what makes up your diet is going to matter. So then we kind of have to do judo with your question, Allison. So it's not, you know, is there science that intermittent fasting is beneficial per se, but can you use it as a tactic to control the total amount of eating you do over, say, the average week? And the answer there is yes. By and large, the science on this topic, and there have been randomized controlled trials, say there is no metabolic magic to it. In other words, if you carefully control your calorie intake every day without fasting, or you fast 2 days out of seven, or you fast 16 or 18 hours a day, and you control calories to the same degree but by a different means, the weight results are the same, the health results are the same. So if you view it as a tactic, then the question becomes, is this a tactic that better helps you control how much you eat? And if your answer is yes, and I feel great doing it, then we say two thumbs up, right? Siskel and Ebert say two thumbs up.
Mark, I have a question. It's interesting because you said you were talking about intermittent fasting. You kind of hear it in the ether. How do these discussions about certain foods, how do these certain foods become popular? Right now it's cauliflower. For a while it was kale. You know how like the Pantone color of the year then permeates the culture?
Oh, yeah.
How do these food...
At least Pantone makes money on like selecting some... I mean, why is it cauliflower? Because we're tired of kale?
Is it really that simple?
I guess. But it's people discover things and then they say, oh, this is great. Well, it was great last year. It's going to be great next year, but it's not going to be cauliflower next year. If I could analyze how trends happen, I would, let's say. But it's beyond me. How it could be kale and now it's cauliflower, I don't know. I always liked cauliflower. It was always good food.
I like cauliflower.
Yeah.
Cauliflower gets to stay. Okay, the name of the book
I
is...
like kale, too.
That's a discussion. The name of the book is How to Eat, All Your Food and Diet Questions Answered. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Mark Bittman and Dr. David Katz. So we've been talking about, you know, there are diets, not eating plans, that say no carbs, all carbs, carbs after a certain hour. Where do you stand on eliminating foods?
Can I just say, I'm going to say one positive thing because that, and then David can answer the diet question. But when he said what you eat matters, that is what matters. And that's the fundamental question. And you can sum it up. You can sum it up by saying you want to eat predominantly. We all know this, by the way. When I say eat a good diet, We all know what that means. And it means eat mostly from the plant kingdom and avoid ultra-processed food, i.e. junk, and don't eat too many animal products. And in fact, if you want to eat almost none or none, that's fine too. Everybody knows that. And that's the sort of fundamental advice. And everything else is spinning around that, trying to confuse matters. And all of those diets, as David just said, all of those diets come down to what do you eat when you eat.
Well,
so,
if we all know this, why doesn't it happen?
Well, we'll take that in stride. So your question, I agree with what Mark just said, but you asked specifically about carbs. And I think the first thing to say, and you maybe use that as an example, right?
I did,
for any restrictive diet. So let me answer about carbs and then branch out. Carbohydrate, it's a kind of molecule, and it's the kind of molecule that makes plants. So the human body has some carbohydrate in it, but we're mostly fat and water and protein. Mm-hmm. Plants are mostly made up of carbohydrate. So when you say cut carbs, you mean cut plant foods. That would mean vegetables, fruits, grains, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds. I mean, all the stuff that if the two of us had to list, what are the foods that are best for health unfailingly? Vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds. In other words, summary judgment about carbohydrate was always, forgive me, people, idiotic. I mean, it's the largest swath of the entire food supply. And so cutting carbs is just silly. The reason for focusing on any kind of restriction is that the typical American is on the seafood diet, right? I see food and I eat it, and there's food everywhere, and a lot of it glows in the dark and is a really dubious idea. So imposing any kind of rules or discipline on that helps people get a grip. And then because these tend to be silly, unbalanced, unsustainable ways of eating, we bop from one to another. Just cut fat, just cut carbs, just cut gluten, just cut lectins, only eat cabbage soup, only eat grapefruit, go keto, go vegan, you know, all these different short-term fats, intermittent fasting. The reality is, if you get the foods right, one of the many virtues of wholesome, minimally processed foods and sensible assemblies is they fill us up on many fewer calories. So, and I think we would both agree, high-quality food, making up a high-quality diet, is probably the single best and most sustainable approach to weight control, too, which is what motivates a lot of people to cut carbs or cut fat and so forth. So, you know, again, any restrictive diet is unlikely to be about health or long-term or lifestyle. It's most likely to be about, I want to lose a certain amount of weight in the short term. But when those diets end, again, the weight typically comes back with interest. And that's no way to live, going on and off diets, as opposed to having a healthy, truly nourishing, and I mean that in every sense of the word, relationship with food.
I do want to dive in on gluten. You mentioned gluten in that answer.
Sure.
Because you ask the question and start to answer it. Is gluten different now than it was 10,000 years ago? And the first sentence says, gluten is the same as it ever was. So what changed that people are having reactions to gluten?
It's part of the same answer as the carb answer, which is that carbs, when people say I'm not eating carbs, they often mean I'm not eating hyper-processed, ultra-processed foods. And that's, to their credit, just the wrong word for that answer. Gluten is a protein, and gluten is gluten. And as far as I know, I think 3% of the population has gluten intolerance and has for a long time.
So there are a couple things to the gluten story. First, so about 1% of the population has celiac disease or makes antibodies to gluten. As much as 10% of the population is sensitive to gluten without making antibodies. That means 90% of all of us have no problems with gluten at all, even now. And it may be that the 10% number, which seems big, is because we're very sensitive to the issue and doctors now go looking for it. And maybe it was there all along and it was just vague symptoms attributable to who knew what. And now we find it and give it a name. But there is a possibility that we actually do have more gluten sensitivity and, by the way, more FODMAP sensitivity and other kinds of dietary sensitivities. And that's because we're disrupting the microbiome. And, of course, there's lots of talk about that. And it makes sense. The microbiome in the intestine is really important in the barrier between what's in the GI tract and what ultimately gets into the bloodstream. And when you alter the colonies of bacteria in the gut, the communications between gut and blood and then ultimately every other system in the body are altered as well. And that includes the immune system. And so I think gluten is the same as it ever was. Human sensitivity to gluten would be the same as it ever was. But if gluten is interacting with the bloodstream and the immune system differently because we've so disrupted the microbiome, then it makes sense we'd see more sensitivity. And we've disrupted the microbiome with everything from food chemicals that were never part of the food supply before, like artificial sweeteners and flavorings and colorizers, ultra-processed food in general, and frankly, significant amounts of antibiotics circulating through the food supply and many other reasons besides.
My guests are Dr. David Katz and Mark Bittman. The name of their book is How to Eat. Let's talk to Karen, who is calling us from Westchester. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. So thank you for taking my call. My issue is, for years I've been having a delicious kale salad for lunch, and I'm, you know, proud of it. I feel good about it, but I always have some blue cheese on it. And recently someone told me, if you're having cheese on your kale, it pretty much knocks out any of the benefits of calcium or from the kale. Like, it's now useless. And now all of a sudden I don't want to eat my salad anymore because it sounds like it's useless now. It's not giving me the benefits of kale.
Before David answers that question, I was surprised that you didn't say you were eating this kale salad every day for lunch and someone told you now had to eat cauliflower salad. But you like that about the cheese knocking out all the benefits of the kale, huh?
That's a new one, yeah. So I can certainly reassure you, Karen, nutritionally, that's just not true. And maybe there's a moral overtone to the advice you're getting, the idea that, you know, you were being good, you were eating kale, and then you added cheese and you're evil and you know, shame on you. I don't know what they meant. Nutritionally, you're actually getting more calcium because, of course, there's concentrated calcium in the cheese. The cheese doesn't do anything to interfere with the absorption of nutrients from the kale. And, you know, there are arguments that you want to be careful about the amount of cheese. So that there's a joke about a salad, right? You know, why am I not losing weight? I eat salad every day for lunch. Well, tell me about your salad. Well, you know, it's a chef salad. So there's ham and there's bologna and there's salami and there's croutons and there's blue cheese dressing and there are big hunks of cheese and, you know, there's a leaf of lettuce. So, you know, if your salad's mostly blue cheese and a leaf of kale, that might be a problem. But otherwise, I think a sprinkle of cheese over something to make it delicious, delightful, so you're willing to eat it every day, and it's a big bowl of kale. I say, Karen,
carry
you
on.
Do you.
Yes.
Yeah, soldier on.
There you go, Karen. Thanks for calling in. Amanda is calling us from Brooklyn. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for calling all of it.
Hi. So my question pertains to breastfeeding mothers and weight loss. I am an exclusively breastfeeding mom. I have an almost 6-month-old. And I'm a very, like, active person, and I eat pretty healthy, but for some reason I lost most of my weight, but I've plateaued now about 10 pounds away from my pre-pregnancy weight, and it's like nothing seems to work as far as getting those last 10 pounds off. And when I try cutting even a little bit of my calories, like I have in the past, my milk supply starts to tank. And so I have no idea what to do to help me, you know, lose that last 10 pounds in a safe way without, like, jeopardizing my milk supply. So do you have any advice for breastfeeding moms who are on this kind of plateau and trying to figure out how to do it without how to lose those last few pounds without affecting their breastfeeding relationship?
Yes. Amanda, I'm looking over at Mark, who's looking at me saying, Doc, you go for this
one.
Well,
I have an answer, but it's not as well-informed as yours.
Okay, but I bet we're going to agree.
Don't lose the weight.
Well, yeah, don't lose it now. If that, you know, I hope you'll be okay with that, Amanda. Keep in mind that the milk in both breasts, it's heavy. And so some portion of the 10 pounds is the milk. And you're carrying that weight to nourish your baby, and that's a beautiful thing. And this is absolutely the best nutrition your baby can get and sets your baby up for better health, better immunity, better weight control. So, you know, I guess at some level we could say, you know, putting up with that weight for a little while longer and accepting the fact that eating the best diet you can to produce a good amount of milk and also to fill that milk with all of its optimal nutrients, you're sort of taking one for the team. So patience. I think what you're doing is exactly right. It sounds like you lost most of the pregnancy weight. This little bit of extra is partly related to hormones, partly related to the milk itself, and will take care of itself when you're done with breastfeeding. But right now, again, you're providing your baby with the best possible nutrition. So good on you, and keep at it, and just be patient.
Amanda, thanks so much for calling. You make that point in the book. There's not a specific number that's the right number on the scale. And that is seems like it has really infected our thinking about food.
Well, it's definitely true. And of course, scales never measured human worth, right? I mean, you know, what you weigh may be what you want it to be or not quite what you want it to be, but we invest way too much value in that. And of course, the value of a mom breastfeeding her baby, one of the most important messages in all of obstetrics and pediatrics, it's, you know, when you can do that, it's so much better than any other way to start out in life.
I have a question here, switch gears a lot, about oils. The good, the bad, canola, olive, corn, safflower, what should we be using?
Well, oils that are liquid at room temperature is sort of a safe way to start. And then you can get into oils and how they're made and how they're processed. So oils that are cold pressed, which really you can almost make olive oil with your hands. It's so easy to make. You press it and you spin it and the oil comes out. Most other oils are more difficult to make, but there's a reason that olive oil has been made for as long as people have been making oil. It was the first, and from many perspectives, it's still the best. And then other oils, if they're extracted without chemicals and extracted mechanically, have different nutritional profiles. Some are slightly better than others, but pretty much if an oil is liquid at room temperature, and an oil has been extracted mechanically, not with chemicals, then it's a good oil.
I'm sliding in one last question. Doctor, if you could just correct one thing that you hear over and over again, just something that you just want to make go away about a food myth, what would it be?
That there's news about nutrition and diet. There really is no, that the big news is there is no news. The big news is that, so we're waiting breathlessly for the new best diet, the new right diet, the new thing to try, the new superfood, the new scapegoat. In those places around the world where people truly derive what we're all entitled to from food, sustenance, and it's nourishing, and it's delicious, and it's pleasurable, and it makes us healthy, and it makes us strong, and it makes us energetic, and we can bequeath it to our children, and it's sustainable, there is no diet news. They eat the way they've eaten for generations. And so here we treat nutrition news like a ping pong ball. It's this, it's that. We, you know, say we're perpetually confused, and so we never really have a mandate to do the right thing. Tune it all out. There's a lot of science about nutrition. New things come along very slowly, and they add incrementally to what we knew before. The idea that what we know about diet and health is going to change with every news cycle is just silly. So the one great message, I think, is
awesome.
There is no diet news.
The name of the book is How to Eat All Your Food and Diet Questions Answered. Mark Bittman and David Katz, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.